Hello everyone, this is Dark Journalist. Tonight I have a special interview for you with Oxford scholar Dr. Joseph Farrell. Dr. Farrell's Giza Death Star book series, which investigates the true age of the Great Pyramid in Egypt and its function as an advanced technology infrastructure of a lost civilization, has been widely influential. Now he's released the new book, Giza Death Star Revisited, which reveals the rediscovery of this ancient technology by inventor Nikola Tesla. Truth is stranger than fiction. Please join us now. Joseph, it's great to have you back. I'm going to start off with Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s announcement for president this week. I was there, and it was definitely electric.
I wish every success to Mr. Kennedy, because somebody needs to come in and restore some sanity to that party.
Yes.
And move it back to the center. If they don't, the backlash against it, and I'm as afraid of that as I am of them getting into permanent power.
Yes.
The backlash against it's going to be absolutely off the charts.
It's going to be, it'll be like Ayatollah land. It's pretty interesting though that Kennedy is running. I think that this represents a kind of a fundamental change in the whole 2024 landscape.
Well, I think so, too. My biggest hope is that unlike Trump, has a network of people that he can put into power if he should run and win. Mm-hmm. Because that's the other thing that needs to be cleaned out, is that whole uniparty in the swamp. Schumer, McConnell, Pelosi, you know, the whole festering mess, and the permanent bureaucracy needs to go.
Yes.
That's where most of this is coming from, is that bureaucracy, and it needs to go.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Fascinating. You know, you mentioned Trump there, and of course Trump this week did something kind of interesting. He went on Tucker Carlson in the middle of this interview talking about Ukraine and all the, D.A. Bragg and all this nonsense of them dragging him in and indicting him for this Stormy Daniels case. He starts talking about Uncle John, and he muses out loud that Uncle John used to tell me so many things. And he starts talking about how he was the longest tenured professor at MIT, and then he said he described the power to me. Do you understand the power? You know, just really. And Tucker Carlson's sort of sitting there with his mouth open. Mm-hmm. But Trump is doing something there, bringing it. He wasn't asked about Uncle John at all. Mm-hmm. And with the Trump Tesla connection, as we know, Uncle John having access to Nikola Tesla's papers. Mm-hmm. What do you make of a comment like that in his first kind of national broadcast of the year?
Frankly, I think he's listening to you.
Yeah.
I really do.
Yeah.
And I think he's thinking that, okay, it's other people out there already know about this stuff, although it's going to be a small but very select circle of people. Mm-hmm. I think the way Trump thinks, or from what I gather, the way he thinks, if he somehow or if somebody in his entourage showed him some of those shows that you've done about his uncle, the way that Trump thinks, I'm thinking, okay, he's thinking it's all right to talk about this stuff now because other people already are.
Right.
So, I don't have to keep my mouth shut.
Mm-hmm.
So I that's honestly what I think. You probably gave him a little nudge.
Mm-hmm. And he says, yes, okay. I kept thinking, there's something about Uncle John, mm-hmm, and the classified hayride that we've had since the Mar-a-Lago raid. Mm-hmm. And if he is listening, and if he knows that this is out there and it's circulating, then he can, in a wide open way, turn around and say to these people that are hounding him, look.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think all of that's a part of it. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't doubt for a moment that he monitors what's said about his family, or has his family monitoring what's said about his family very carefully. Mm-hmm. So I don't have any doubt that part of this is coming from the raid, from the pressure on the classified document story. You know, and again, why does this kid in Boston get hammered for classified documents leak when we have, you know, the Trump situation, and then we have Joe Biden with his own classified document problem? I mean,
exactly.
This is so off the charts, in our face, that, you know, we are living no longer in a republic, but a banana republic with two sets of rules.
Right.
You know, it's just off the charts. Daniel, I so want to get out of this country.
Why?
I cannot stand it. I'm not the kind of person that can live in galloping hypocrisy. I left the Episcopal Church for that reason decades ago.
Oh, yes.
You know, I can't do it.
Joseph, can you hang in there until the 2024 election's over?
That's the other thing. Are we even going to have an election?
I know.
Or is it going to be another steal? You know.
Yeah.
You know, will somebody out there? You know, I'm listening to all these conservative, so-called conservative talk show hosts, and it dumbfounds me what they're saying.
Yeah.
We get Sean Vanity, and I don't know if you've been listening to that creep lately. But my God, he's out there talking about where Republicans need to take a page from the Democrats and start doing what they're doing in order for us to win elections again. Wow. In other words, what he's saying is Republicans need to learn how to cheat.
Yes.
Or at least cheat better.
Right, yeah. <laughs> You know? <laughs> And he has like a live audience now. It's like, hey, it's the Jimmy Fallon show.
It's off the charts wacko out here in talk radio land. What happened? Rush died. That's what happened. the voice of reason is gone.
Joseph, I want to ask you this because you
We live, by the way? Are we recording?
We're recording.
Okay. I'll try and watch my language better. I didn't think we were. Apologies, folks.
I thought about live. I knew we were going to go over the rainbow.
Somewhere. I'm not Judy Garland. I won't even pretend to be. But I'm right really there. Judy Garland, folks. Yeah, there we go.
You know, and I have the book. I've been getting into the book. It's fantastic. I want to launch into the whole thing.
The Wizard of Oz? What are we talking about here?
Well, in a sense, yes. It's the Giza Death Star.
Oh, okay. Okay.
This wonderful book. Right. And thank you for sending it to me because I was able to glean so much out of it. I'm going to go through it and read it all again, but I gathered a series of questions for us to go over for it.
Okay.
Before we launch into it, I just wanted to run this one thing about the John Trump scenario again.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's possible, because I've re-explored, I went through a lot of the footage of John Trump talking. And one of the things I caught, which I'd never caught before, was that he said, well, one of the unusual things I found among the papers were letters to the czar. And letters saying to the czar, I can help you to build this weapon to defend yourself. And presumably the idea was against Hitler, but the dates are all wrong.
How weird.
Yeah. So here, you know, he also said he ran across these letters to the King of England, but here he was talking about this kind of death ray protection weapon. But Trump said it was specifically to the czars.
So I'm not surprised.
Okay.
I'm not surprised at that for a very simple reason. Tesla, if you go back and look at his little op-ed pieces that he would occasionally write for the New York Times, or for that matter, there were people that would publish these little articles in the New York Times about Tesla's latest invention. It was after J.P. Morgan pulled the financial plug on his Wardenclyffe, you know, wireless power project. And then Tesla was sued in New York court in 1915 by one of the other financial backers of the Wardenclyffe scheme. And that's where Tesla actually, you can go and read the New York trial transcripts. In fact, I have some of those trial transcripts in Babylon's Banksters, where you can read the exchange going on, where Tesla is outlining for the court how that system would have worked. Okay. It's in those trial transcripts where Tesla says, I had to have this apparatus get a grip on the earth in order for it to shake or make the earth quiver.
Yeah.
That it's in that trial transcript where that famous quotation occurs.
You reproduce that in the book.
I reproduce that in this book as well, yes, but it first appeared in Babylon's Banksters.
Got it.
Because I've been trying, you know, I've been trying to let out clues for people to follow, and no one's following. But anyway, after Morgan shuts him down, it's very interesting to see what Tesla starts to do. Because World War I, by that point, of course, is raging in Europe. And Tesla begins to write these articles or make statements, and then the press comes and interviews him, about the use of this system as a weapon. That's when he first starts disclosing that possibility for its use. And he does, in fact, offer it to the U.S. Army. They turn him down, although I think they turn part of him down. That's another part of the story.
So you might be taking us around 1910?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. It would be in that time frame that Trump is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
He offers it to England, and he offers it to Russia. In other words, he's offering it to everybody but the Central Powers.
Ah.
And I think, again, the reason why is that Tesla grew up as the son of a Serbian Orthodox priest, but in the Austro-Hungarian part of Serbia at the time. So, in other words, you know, he has no love lost for the Habsburg monarchy.
Mm.
But I think it's clear that because Morgan pulls the plug, that's when you start to see Tesla come clean and say this can be used as a very powerful weapon.
Ah.
And people need to remember that. And this ultimately, I think, is why Morgan does pull the plug.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think Morgan, you know, the story I've never bought that Morgan pulls the plug because he couldn't meter the system,
mm-hmm.
which I think is BS. If Morgan's concern is to make money, he stood to make buku amounts of money off the royalties of appliances using that system.
Right.
So, you know, this has never been an explanation that made much sense. What I think happened is that somebody in Tesla's entourage of technicians and scientists, probably somebody like Charles Steinmetz or somebody like that, that was familiar enough with Tesla's research, having worked with him for so long, that went to Morgan and told him, hey, this system can be used, you know, for a lot more than just beaming wireless power around the world. You know, and Tesla's on record as, you know, this system can split the earth. Well, you know, we don't want that. You know.
Incredible things that he says about it. But this is fascinating because you think that J.P. Morgan took it off the market, as it were, and continued on with it underground.
Well, at least he took it off the market. I think the other part of the problem that, and I've been maintaining this since Babylon's Banksters, because if you read that book very carefully, the thing I point out there is that at that time, you're dealing with a system that's relatively easy to engineer. Anybody with some competency at that period of time in electrical engineering, Steinmetz, you know, people like that, could have engineered that system as a weapon. And the powers that be have no way to control the proliferation of it. This is a relatively simple system and a relatively inexpensive system to build. So, you know, we can't have the Hottentots in Africa building this dang thing or we're in trouble. You know, that's the way they're going to be thinking. Or for that matter, we can't have the Germans or the Austro-Hungarians or, God forbid, the Ottoman Turks, you know, or whoever.
Right. Yeah.
You know, building this dang thing. So Morgan, you know, the other part of this that's very interesting, at least to me, is that the late Lieutenant Colonel Tom Bearden always maintained in his published writings that the Lorentz transformations, which are a set of equations that the Dutch physicist Hendrik Lorentz devised, were the creation, so to speak, the accounting trick that J.P. Morgan forced Lorentz to come up with to divert attention away from Tesla's system. Now, the reason that that's significant is that Bearden didn't make any comment like that without having some basis for doing so, although I've never been able to find anywhere in the literature any corroboration of it. So, you know, here's Bearden making this very strange statement. But the reason that's so significant is, of course, the Lorentz transforms form the core argument of Einstein's special relativity.
Right.
That's, you know, that's just how important these this set of equations are. So, you know, who knows what's going on here, but Bearden's point, and I think your point, is that at some point Tesla was on to something with this system, and it had to be covered up.
Right.
And this, there's a part of this system that I hope people caught when they read the book. Because in the book, I point out that Tesla, this, when he's doing his Colorado Springs experiments, Tesla is trying to calculate the velocity of these electroacoustic pulses that he's creating with this apparatus. And he calculates the velocity of this pulse to be pi divided by 2 times the velocity of light. In other words, he's calculating the velocity of these pulses to exceed that of the velocity of light.
Interesting.
And incidentally, if you're paying attention, that ratio of pi divided by 2 is exactly the ratio of the height to the width of the Great Pyramid.
Oh, wow.
So in other words, what I'm trying to get people to clue in here is that that structure is built as a precise incorporation of a length-to-mass conversion factor that Tesla himself discovers.
Fascinating.
So along comes Einstein with special relativity and says, no, no, no. Velocity of light is the upper speed limit of, you know, we can't go faster than that, folks. Well, yeah, this is the problem. We've been dealing with Einstein ever since.
Right.
And therefore, if you have that dogma, you tend to throw out anything that Tesla says.
Yeah.
Who is, incidentally, let it be pointed out, incidentally, saying these things as the result of experiment and observation.
Right.
Let's remember this.
Yeah. This is not just theoretical.
This is not just Einstein doing his thought experiments and creating equations on it. No, this is not the same thing. This is actual science and experiment. So, yeah, I think something about Tesla's system spooked the financial powers that be, and they did not want anybody investigating this system any further, because they knew that it was potentially a very powerful, very dangerous system, and they didn't want a lot of yahoos getting their hands on it. Now, that said, there is an aspect of the system that I think was used, because let's remember what Tesla did in that system. What he does is he inverted the normal circuit parameters of broadcast circuitry. In other words, a radio has an antenna, it broadcasts a signal, and the return loop in the circuit is what? It's the ground. It's the earth itself. Right. And every electrical circuit has the ground as part of its circuit. Okay? Every single one. So what Tesla does is he simply flips the whole circuit parameters so that the antenna of the system becomes the planet itself and the ground becomes the atmosphere.
Oh, wow.
So in his wireless system, what is actually beaming power to you is the Earth. Why? Well, he says in the trial transcript, I had to get a grip on the Earth in order to be able to make the Earth quiver. In other words, he's actually modulating information into the signals he's putting into the Earth. So, you know, that's genuine radio if you're modulating a signal.
Right.
So, in other words, he's creating not only a broadcast power system, he's creating a communication system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, interestingly enough, most people don't know this. You really, really have to dig to find this out. But when General Pershing takes the American Expeditionary Force over to France after this country enters the war, the Allies, the French and the British, to a lesser extent, the Belgians, are mystified as to why Pershing seems to be getting communications from Washington so quickly.
Huh.
And the reason is we put into play a very low frequency Earth broadcast system before World War I. So, in other words, we were using essentially a part of Tesla's concepts in that war to communicate directly from Washington to Europe without the use of transatlantic cables, without the use of telegraphy that the British could sneak in and listen in on. No. They were using a Tesla system.
Interesting.
Most people don't realize that. Now, folks, it's very common now with nuclear submarines and so on to use this type of system to communicate with them. But that's the proof of the pudding, that the system works. All that Tesla was wanting to do was scale up the broadcast power tremendously. Because remember the other thing about this system, Daniel, is if you have a sphere, imagine you've got a hollow sphere for a moment, and you wrap the sphere, a Helmholtz resonator, okay, and you wrap that sphere, and it produces a tone.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the tone itself is a sound wave, which is a wave of what? Compression and rarefaction that spreads out over the surface of the sphere and then contracts to the antipode on the opposite side of where you hit it and then spreads out again and comes back. Okay, and it keeps doing that until the wave dissipates. All right. So in Tesla's system, what Tesla was planning to do, and the reason he said, oh, I can split the planet with this, is at the exact moment that that wave is reflected back, you pulse it again so that the whole process never damps.
Uh-huh.
Eventually, you're loading enough energy into this standing wave that, yeah, the planet cracks apart. It's got too much energy. It can't damp. Kaboom. It blows up.
Fascinating.
Yeah, that's a weapon, folks.
Yeah.
it's a planet destroyer. And it's a planet destroyer now. And the thing is, depending on how you configure the pulse, you can do that through interferometry so that your pulse can start at any point on the surface of the planet and it will reflect to the antipode and back.
Wow.
Constantly. So this is a system that demands that you have a grip of the Earth, and then secondly, demands that you have enough mathematics to figure out how to configure that pulse so that it will start anywhere on the surface of the planet and end anywhere else on the surface of the planet. And the way you do that is beam mixing, interferometry. That's how you do it.
Fascinating.
It's a very easy, simple idea. This is why it's so dangerous. Forget about having to engineer hydrogen bombs, folks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. You know, this is relatively easy.
Yeah, right. That's interesting. And do you think then Tesla, the flip side of it is, you know, okay, on one side you can use it as a weapon mm-hmm. and split the earth. The flip side of it is perpetual energy.
Sure.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Tesla himself, as he's, if you look at the information that I include in the book, Tesla himself actually says that when you master these vortices of nature, and it's very interesting that he's already thinking in these terms. In other words, Tesla kind of makes this leap past Einstein right into quantum mechanics, you know,
yes.
because, you know, he's just not interested in Albert Einstein. And by the way, you know, for folks that are interested, they did know each other. And okay, Tesla yeah. had little use for Einstein's mathematics.
Yeah.
go away, you know, do something useful, get a haircut. But
he thought it was completely secondary. Like,
yeah, he did. He yeah. did. And quite frankly, let's look at what the two men are interested in. Einstein's interested in gravity. Mm-hmm. Tesla's interested in electromagnetics.
Right.
So the focus of the two men are on entirely different forces and phenomena. Mm-hmm. But Tesla actually says this, by means of being able to control these vortices, humanity will be able to have cosmic power. And he goes on to say, we can create or destroy entire worlds at will. And he makes no apology and no holds barred as to the extent of the power of the system he's talking about. It is truly cosmic in its scale, and he pulls no punches, and he's right. Mm-hmm. It is.
Wow, this is incredible. When you think about that piece with Trump, John Trump reading mm-hmm. In these papers that mm-hmm. Tesla had written, not to, you know, the modern World War II people about, you mm-hmm. know, fighting against Hitler, but that he was saying, I can help you develop this kind of death ray defense against mm-hmm. these people. But John Trump says it's to the czars that he's saying it. What do you make of that now with the timeline that you're talking about? This all adds up.
I'm not surprised that he would also make it to the czars. Mm-hmm. Tesla's background is Orthodox. His father was a priest. And at that time, people have to remember that even for someone like Tesla, who's, you know, an avowed agnostic, that cultural attraction and pull cannot be denied. And Russia, particularly during the Tsarist period prior to World War I, and you see this happening again today. Russia assumed the role as the protector, the great power protector of Orthodox Christianity in Europe and the Middle East. That was the entire reason that Russia was backing Serbia. It was the entire reason that in the late 19th century, Russia actually marched right to the gates of Constantinople. Mm-hmm. Before the rest of Europe said, oh, no, you know, we can't let you in there and have that, which is what the Russians really wanted in that war. The Treaty of San Sebastian prevented them from getting it, 1888 or 9, somewhere around there. And it was Bismarck that brokered that. But again, you've got to understand Russia is acting in its role as the protector of those civilizations, and Tesla coming out of that kind of milieu with his own father being a clergyman is, you know, the czars are a natural place that you'd want to take and offer an invention like that.
Oh yeah. And,
you know, they've got the money to do it, you know, mm-hmm. and they've certainly got the scientific infrastructure and the scientists to do it as well. So yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
Wow. Incredible. And it's interesting too, because in the middle of all this time period, you have the Tunguska
Yep.
Incident. And this is either a gigantic meteorite, or it's the explosion of a weapon, or it's, you know, an alien invasion. What on earth, you know, when you think about Russia in relation to this Tesla thing about the weapon, is that a hint or a clue that they were using this or trying it out?
Well, there are a lot of people, Daniel, that think that Tesla's system had something to do with Tunguska.
Wow.
I'm not entirely convinced, but I'm also willing to consider it, because of all the explanations of Tunguska out there, no one has come up with one that is plausible. You know, we even have people out there maintaining that it was an antimatter-matter reaction that, you know, caused that massive explosion.
Mm-hmm.
We have the nuclear people, we have the meteorite people, but each one of these things has some problem with it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not aware that anybody has found enough radioactivity at that site to explain it in terms that would involve nuclear reactions. Well, okay, if it's not nuclear, then what kind of reaction was it?
Mm-hmm.
An electroacoustic reaction could do the same thing if it were powerful enough.
Oh, interesting.
The problem is that the most eyewitness reports have this thing as an air burst rather than as something that happened on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
You can configure Tesla's system to get an airburst, certainly, but it would be more difficult. But again, you know, my point here is nobody has come up with an explanation for Tunguska. I'm not willing to discount Tesla providing a little demonstration to the very people he wants to give the system to.
Mm-hmm.
And doing so in the middle of nowhere where, you know, it's not likely that anybody is going to be hurt from the demonstration.
Right.
So who knows?
That is fascinating. Well, if it was not the Tesla system, what do you think is the best candidate for this kind of unexplained, inexplicable explosion in history that just wiped out a whole slice of Siberia?
Oh, boy. Oh, I want to say so many things here. I'm having to bite my tongue, Daniel, because I'm waiting for that second book, kind of the sequel to the Giza Death Star Revisited, to come out. Because once it does, and once people really grab onto what is being said there, I think it will clear up a lot of stuff. But without having to get into that, all I'll say is I think that the other possible alternative that could explain something like that would be a small matter-antimatter reaction where a containment suddenly broke down and kablooey. That kind of reaction would get you the kind of damage you see there. It would explain why there's not much residual radioactivity in that region and so on and so forth. Because remember, a matter-antimatter reaction is a total annihilation reaction.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it is. So you get lots of energy out of it, but, you know, radioactivity and all of this other stuff, not so much like, you know, an fission or fusion reaction. So I'm thinking that's probably the best other explanation.
Fascinating. Wow.
Why the two might be related, people are just going to have to wait.
It might
have been a demonstration from other things.
Interesting. Okay, so obviously in traditional science, any ability, technical ability to do that is decades out from...
No, I don't think so. I think actually what we may be seeing is aspects of science that became known and started to be experimented with in the very first days of electricity. In other words, Michael Faraday, Ben Franklin, you know, all these people that are doing experiments with electricity. I think by the time of the Manhattan Project, you have people asking questions that are getting dangerously close. One of them being David Bohm.
Oh, right.
David Bohm is a very important figure because he was honest enough to say what was on everybody else's mind. We'll just leave it at that. I think by the time of the Manhattan Project, you've got a bunch of scientists that realize, oh, we are just skimming the surface.
Wow. Incredible.
I will give a hint to you.
Oh, yeah.
Bohm is the physicist, as you know, the famous quantum physicist that was involved in plasma research.
Oh.
And I've mentioned this in my books before. I have mentioned him again. Mm-hmm. I give out these little clues and people don't pay attention.
We've seen that a few times.
Yes. I did the Cosmic War, which allowed me to go as close as I dared at the time. And what did I do in the Cosmic War? I talked about plasma cosmology. Throw out the Big Bang, folks.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Why? What did Bohm say? What did he do? Well, Bohm noticed that plasmas behave very peculiarly.
Mm-hmm.
When he attempted for the Manhattan Project to insert electrical probes into a plasma to determine what was going on, what happened? The plasma built an electromagnetic sheath around the probe.
Oh.
Bohm's response was, oh my God, it's acting like it's alive.
Oh, wow.
Why? Because the plasma responded exactly as your body or my body does to the introduction of a virus or a germ or a pathogen. It walls it off and creates a membrane around it so that it does not enter or affect your body. That's exactly what plasmas do.
Fascinating.
And here's the bad news. He wasn't the only one noticing weird things happening in plasmas that resemble life. Now, I want you to stop and let that soak in.
Hmm.
99% of all matter in the universe is not solid, liquid, or gas. It's plasma. So, in other words, the physics that Albert Einstein, Isaac Newton, Euclid, Galileo, Copernicus, and so on have been doing is the physics of 1% of the matter in the universe.
Hmm.
The other 99% is a very, very different matter, and I'm deliberately punning on all the possible meanings of that word. Now stop and remember something else. What's the ancient Egyptian religion tell you? It tells you that stars are alive.
Oh, right.
What are stars? They're big hot balls of plasma.
Right, yes.
Uh-huh. Now, here's a big problem for you. I mentioned this in the book that we're waiting to be published. There's a lot more in that book, but I'm going to mention something else since I'm letting out clues. In May of 1999, Daniel, the solar wind from our sun stopped.
Oh, wow.
Stopped. Turned off.
For how long?
2 days.
What on earth?
Uh-huh. Now, what on earth indeed if the sun is a big chained up hydrogen bomb?
Ah, right.
The fact that it stopped tells you something very significant about the sun. It's not a big chained up hydrogen bomb. That's just a little part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So what was going on during that 2 days? There's no solar wind and the sun is just shining like it always did. What's going on? What's happening? What's the source of energy? Go back to what I've been saying all along. When you detonate a nuclear bomb, energy is transduced from what? From the local configuration of space-time, from the local system parameters. That's where the energy is coming from. What did Tesla say about his system? The energy that you are getting out of those electroacoustic impulses is dependent upon the geometry of the circuit, and get this, and the amount of segmentation in that circuit. Think Great Pyramid here, folks. Yeah. What is the Great Pyramid? Well, viewed in Tesla terms, it's a gigantic piezoelectric circuit with massive amounts of segmentation. The more segmentation, the more energy you get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. That's yeah, amazing. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
This is interesting because, and this gets around actually to this book, which is the new book, but there's a new book coming after this one.
Right.
This book ties up all the stuff that you were doing with the Death Star book series, but you said there's stuff in here now, and I can read the things that you're adding, which you couldn't let out in that period because they wouldn't have been accepted.
They were too, there's an epigraph in this book, The Giza Death Star Revisited, that was in the original version of The Giza Death Star that I sent out to a different publisher other than Adventures Unlimited. And it's a little epigraph that I restored in this book.
Wow.
And the reason I restored it is that I had, as I write in the book, I had every intention of doing a webinar on my website about this little, the implication of this little epigraph. But I said, no, I'm going to write a second book about this thing because people need to understand what's going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
In plasma physics. They really need to get a clue here because, Daniel, I guarantee you, it ties everything together. Cosmic War, Giza Death Star, even a bit of patristics.
Wow.
In fact, quite a lot of patristics.
Uh-huh.
But
CERN?
That too. Yeah, that too, in a very weird way. And it's all based on plasma and plasma physics, because that's what we're dealing with here. That's what we are dealing with. You know, the Great Pyramid is nothing but a big crystal, if you stop and look at it. And it's a crystal composed of gobs of other crystals, you know, from microscopic little quartz crystals embedded in the granite and limestone of the structure to the stones of the structure to the structure itself. So, you know, it's a massively redundant feedback set of feedback loops that are all dimensional analogs of each other. So there's more feedback loops. This thing was engineered to the nth degree. And in my opinion, you know, the way I want people to approach this book, Daniel, is it's a briefing document.
Mm-hmm.
Because the weapon hypothesis is not my own. It's Zechariah Sitchin's.
Right.
And Sitchin spent a whole book writing about it from his understanding of ancient texts. He does not get into what he thinks made it work. That's where I pick up. Okay, how do we, on the basis of present scientific knowledge, how can we account for that hypothesis?
Well, in my opinion, there's two ways to do it, and both of them involve this electroacoustic impulse technology, Tesla, Townsend Brown, and people like this that are experimenting with this stuff. How do we account for its missing components? You know, this is a very complex argument, and part of it deals with what I think we're missing from the Grand Gallery inside the structure.
Mm-hmm.
At the time I wrote the Giza Death Star, hypothesized about something I was calling phi crystals, you know, the Greek letter phi.
Right.
And by using that, I was trying to clue people in that I'm thinking in terms of the Fibonacci sequence and a vorticular structure. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I thought at the time, Daniel, that this was just totally flaky. I was thinking, Farrell, you're absolutely nuts. So you better take out that epigraph when you resubmit the book to David Childress. And I did. I took the epigraph out, the one that I restored in this book.
And that's like 2003.
That's 2003. Yeah. I'm talking about these phi crystals. Well, lo and behold, in this book, I point out that MIT, it's right in your neck of the woods, that scientists at MIT have come up with something that they call a photonic crystal.
Oh, yes.
That actually traps something that they're calling tired light inside the crystal.
Okay.
And you'll have to read it in the book because I'm not saying this. They are.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, I was saying, okay, I was thinking if you could take light and induce an index of refraction within a crystal to trap that light, what would you have? Well, you'd have a mini singularity.
Oh, right.
All right. And that means, in turn, that you would have a crystal exerting an extraordinary amount of gravitational pull as a consequence of that. And the reason I was coming up with that is that when you read Sitchin's texts, it's very clear from the way he's interpreting the text that there is an extraordinary amount of gravitational pull being exercised by the pyramid on certain individuals described in the text.
Interesting.
Okay, so what would do that? Well, I'm thinking a very strange crystal could do that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, lo and behold, MIT, just a couple of years ago, has invented what they're calling a photonic crystal, which their own scientists are describing as, well, imagine a gemstone that you're rotating fast enough that the light itself is being refracted entirely inside the crystal and cannot escape.
Oh.
You have, and this is their words, you would have a kind of singularity.
Hmm.
I'm thinking, okay, there we go. There's my phi crystals, and I was thinking, you know, give them 300 or 400 years. No, it was only 20.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. So you
this
know,
this is a rediscovery of that ancient technology, in fact.
In my opinion, yes.
Yeah.
In my opinion. I think the metamaterials research now is making possible things that were I regarded at the time as being the most speculative and outlandish part of the hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so what's the restored epigraph? And I've been challenging people to spot it because I've let them know I restored the epigraph. What's the epigraph? It's on page 83.
Oh.
And it's in that chapter that's titled The Paleography of Paleophysics, Ancient Texts, Ancient Wars, and the Origin of the Weapon Hypothesis. And once again, it's Zechariah Sitchin. Now, when you hear this epigraph, you'll know immediately why I had to take it out of the original Giza Death Star. And I think you're going to clue in why I've restored it on the basis of my hints now.
Okay.
Quote, "An Akkadian book of Job
entitled Ludlow Belnemeki, I Praise the Lord of Darkness, refers to, quote, the irresistible demon that has exited from the acre, unquote, in a land, quote, across the horizon in the lower world, bracket, Africa, close bracket, end quote. Now, acre is the Akkadian word for a mountain or a ziggurat,
right,
or a pyramid. So in other words, Sitchin is referring to a text that says that there was a demon in a pyramid. And he's doing that. He's that quotation appears in his book, The Wars of Gods and Men, in the context of a war fought for possession of the pyramid.
Right.
Right. Now, throwing a demon into the mix complicates things.
This is a little different.
So, you know, that's the reason I said, okay, enough is enough. I'm speculating wildly. We're just
here. You are. You're dealing with all these technical aspects. Yes.
And
you're
now we're dealing with the ancient story. toil and bubble around the cauldron. We're going to be like the witches at Macbeth trying to figure out what the hell is going on here. Emphasis on hell here. But
you make an excellent point, which is a lot of the things that come down as sort of magical rites and spells seems like almost degraded versions of keeping the technology aspect alive.
Well, now, again, I restore some of that stuff in this second book.
Okay.
You notice in this book, in Giza Death Star Revisited, I took all of that stuff out of the Giza Death Star.
Yeah.
It's not repeated here. The reason it was in the original Giza Death Star is, yeah, I did want to clue people in that there is an occult aspect to this, but I don't want to talk about it too much, so we're going to divert your attention by pointing out, look at what these seals do. They look like electrical circuitry diagrams. Well, they're back in that second book that we're waiting for. Why? Because if you look at what electricity is, what is it doing? It's a plasma.
Oh, right.
So you're dealing, I think, ultimately with something that does make sense, but you have to approach it very carefully, and you have to approach it, with the technical aspect. Once you get that down, then you throw the demon into the mix. And once you do, then things begin to make a lot of sense. Now, I am not saying here, folks, that this is metaphor. I do think that scientists like Bohm are on to something when they're pointing out, hey, this stuff is behaving wildly and weirdly too much like life.
So in fact, it's almost like a conjuring of an actual conscious being.
Yes. What has Elon Musk been warning us about AI? You see, my point here is, folks, we are no longer in the easy position of being able to deal with Victorian era materialism. We are dealing with the physics of the 99% of the universe,
Yes.
And we've barely made a scratch in our understanding of it. We do know that this stuff, remember what plasma is. It's a kind of matter that does not exist in atoms. So in other words, you're not even dealing with molecules of stuff. You can have uranium plasmas. It's just that the electrons and the nucleus of the uranium are not all together in an atom. you're dealing with something very different and very weird. And within these plasmas, you can have discrete regions which are, guess what, walled off from each other by membranes.
Oh, yeah, right. That's very much like a living system again.
That's very much like a living system again. And then on top of this, you go and you look at the plasma filaments that they've taken pictures of now in the universe, and then you compare it to neurons in a brain. And the resemblance is more than I defy anybody to tell me that there's not a qualitative resemblance that's off the chart.
Alternative beings.
And that means that the ancient view of the universe is, as I've been trying to point out for several years now, as an organism rather than mechanism, is now beginning to have a basis in actual science. It's the mechanism view of things that's outdated and simplistic.
That's the problem.
That's the problem.
And that's why we're kind of caught flat-footed with all this technology coming in and dealing with it in this mechanistic fashion and igniting all these spirits, in fact.
Right. What happens when we set off the A-bomb? What starts to show up in our skies?
UFOs.
UFOs.
Oh, yeah.
Remember the space shuttle tether experiment?
Yes.
Have you seen the videos of all that stuff?
Yes.
That suddenly starts to show up, acting as if it's investigating what the hell is that and what are these monkeys doing?
Right.
I think we are living in a much more living universe. And when we set off the bomb, what we've done is we've just announced to, to all of that stuff that we're here and they come and investigate. And incidentally, what is the bomb? Well, it's a plasma.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's the central core. That's exactly what it is.
Right. Now, stop and think, Daniel. I've just told you about the sun and the solar wind having shut down for 2 days, and yet it's still going.
Mm-hmm.
So the chained up hydrogen bomb model is only a part of the picture here.
Right.
It's gating energy from the entire circuit. And what's the circuit? It's a plasma.
Interesting.
That explains why I've been getting at all along, that when you set off these bombs, you're gating energy into the reaction from the geometry, from the circuit parameters of local space.
Yeah.
Absolutely you are.
Yeah.
Absolutely you are. And if anybody's out there, that's going to grab their attention.
Right. Well, this is so interesting because there's a guy in the 50s there, Wilhelm Reich.
Ding, ding, ding.
Okay. He gets absolutely obsessed with the idea that UFOs are plasma and that they are hiding out inside clouds.
Yeah. Well, what's a thunderstorm cloud? It's a plasma.
Okay. Yes. Absolutely. Right.
Yeah, what's lightning? It's a plasma.
Yes.
And for that matter, let's just cut to the chase here. Why is that stuff called plasma to begin with? Well, it's because an American Nobel laureate chemist by the name of Irving Langmuir looked at the stuff and said, oh, well, this resembles life, so let's call it a plasma.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah, okay. Very interesting.
Right.
Yeah. You exist, I exist, every living creature exists inside of a bioplasma cloud that's actually outside of our bodies and that is unique to us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the COVID, give each other 6 feet. Well, that's what they're talking about.
Right.
You know, so I'm thinking that, yeah, we've had physicists, Tesla, Townsend Brown, that have been playing with this electrical acoustic shockwave technology for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. And they've noticed that its behavior is wildly different than your standard liquid gas or solid matter, because you're dealing with something that is not going to I just love Hannes Alfvén here. You know, Alfvén is kind of the father of plasma physics and a Nobel laureate for that matter. And Alfvén, you know, said that the confident predictions of thermonuclear fusion as a source of energy didn't come about because the plasmas, and these are his words, the plasmas stubbornly refused to believe in them. You know, and I have to wonder, why does this physicist choose the diction of active agency?
Yes.
On the part of what he's talking about.
Right. He's making it sound like it made a conscious choice.
Yeah, precisely. And
you mentioned T.T. Brown there.
Yeah.
There's a couple of odd things about T.T. Brown. I talked to members of his family and people who'd worked closely with him. And there's a lot of things that are still hanging out there about T.T. Brown that, you know, those experiments went deep, deep underground.
Oh, they did.
Yes, in fact, they did. During one of his time experiments, after he does it, he goes to his family and he says, "We're taking off. We're going to Eleuthera Island." And they hang out there with a lot of bodyguards for a few months. And Rand Corporation is involved in all the rest. One of the things that grabbed me there was this invention that disappeared quickly, which the family members talked to me about, called the acoustic fan.
Yes.
And the acoustic fan, one of the properties that it had when the person working on him with it actually experienced the effects of this, which is it showed him the entire length of his life and the different things he was going to do. You know, it showed him a complete timeline of his life. It futured him out, as it were. And that during this process, when they were doing this, and the guy was pretty young when T.T. Brown was working with them, he said to him, you know, "Do you believe in time travel?" Brown said that to his assistant. And he said, "Well, I think, you know, I think it could be true." And he said, "Well, what would you do if you had this ability, you know, to time travel?" He said, "I'd go back in time." And the guy's sister had died very young. He said, "I'd go back in time and save her." And Brown said, "Well, that might not be allowed, but you're thinking, you know, the right way about the idea that you could travel backwards and forwards in time. What do you think, in relation to this and the things that you're talking about with Brown, how far did he get? And is that why his work was driven so far underground?"
Well, I spent an equal amount of time in this book going into Brown's work as I do with Tesla.
Yes.
For the reason that Brown himself is also working with other aspects of these electroacoustic or electrogravitic, as he would have called it, impulses. Mm-hmm. And he's discovering the same things as Tesla. He's discovering that the circuit parameters, the dielectric constant, the inductance, the resistance, you know, all of this stuff. He's discovering that the circuit parameters are what are crucial to making the system work. That's number one. So for someone working with those concepts, it's natural that Brown is going to think, okay, there's a time connection here. Mm-hmm. And let's shift this into the pyramid context once again. There's a whole branch of research on the Great Pyramid that I call pyramid as prophecy. Mm-hmm. You know, these people that view the structure as a kind of biblical dispensationalist evangelical Christian prophecy in stone. Now, that sounds like a wacky idea, and indeed it is. But there is an interesting aspect to that idea in that you cannot view the Great Pyramid and its measures, and you cannot view any, and this is very important, you'll see the connection in a moment, you cannot view any measure of mass as anything more than a three-dimensional length-to-mass conversion function. So in other words, if I have a measure that's as long as my back scratcher here, and I call this a ferrule, and I put this ferrule into a square cube along the three axes of space, length, width, and height, and I construct a container out of that length measure based on the cubing or the dimensional rotation into three dimensions, and then stuff it with a regular material of a known weight, and then measure that weight or mass in that container, I now have a unit of measure based on this conversion factor and a known substance, like water. Okay. That's what we do. That's our system of mass measurements. It's nothing but a known length converted to a three-dimensional container, and then you put it with a regular material substance of a known specific weight. And you measure the weight. All right. Anytime you have a mass measurement, you are also dealing with time.
Right.
Because that whole thing is in a dynamic system that's constantly slowly changing. So you're also measuring time anytime you have these types of measuring systems. Now, in the pyramid case, I suspect, and I get into this in the book, you know, this is a very complex argument that I'm trying to make here, but I suspect that as a result of this, time itself is a harmonic phenomenon. As we know, how do you measure frequency? Well, so many beats or cycles per what? Per unit of time. So in other words, time, if you really get down to it, you know, A440 at the note A at 440 hertz per second, cycles per second, that's a time measurement. And it's also a measure of a particular harmonic. So you cannot have, here's my point, you cannot have a building like the Great Pyramid, which has so many, almost an infinite number of redundant multiples that are all harmonics of each other. In other words, multiples of two or divisors of two. Multiples of three or divisors of three, and so on. You know, I'm a pipe organist. I recognize these numbers because they're on my stop jams on any pipe organ I play. So, you know, okay, well, that's harmonics. Okay, so if you're dealing with a structure, Daniel, that's nothing but nested harmonics, what are you dealing with? You're dealing with a structure that is quintessentially, at its root and core, all about time. Once you've said that, and then once you get across the idea that this structure may have been able to produce an effect at a distance simply through tuning it to that target can be anything in local space or time. In other words, it can have a retrocausative effect. It can have a precausative effect, or the effect that you've tuned in doesn't appear until later than the person turning the dials. Follow me?
Yeah.
So in other words, the whole thing is harmonics, and time itself is a harmonic. What does that mean? It means that when Townsend Brown is asking his friend, do you believe in time travel? And his friend says, well, and I'm going to go back and fix my sister. And then Brown gives him a caution that may not be possible. What I suspect, Daniel, is because time is a harmonic, and this is going to require people to really think, and I mention this in the book, so I'm not giving away anything that's not in the book.
Right.
The classic argument against time travel has been the so-called grandfather paradox, that you and I cannot travel back and accidentally shoot our grandfather because if we did so, then we disappear, or, you know, and it causes all sorts of conundrums that we can't figure out.
Right.
And on it goes. All right. Now, what I suspect is something very different. You and I, if we examine our uniqueness, mathematically, it's impossible that you or I should be here. Because we are all products of a long chain of ancestors and genetics and, you know, the genetics that lead to us, mm-hmm. Daniel Lister, Joseph P. Farrell.
Mm-hmm.
So the odds of us ever being here are microscopic, and that means each one of us individuals is absolutely a miracle in and of ourselves.
Incredible. Yeah.
Now, it also means that we have a problem of trying to explain what happens with the doppelganger or the twin.
Mm-hmm.
The doppelganger is a phenomenon that we've all encountered at some point in our lives. Of someone that looks like someone we know, but is no relation to them whatsoever.
Yes.
And the resemblance is so profound that it's not only physical, but in many cases can be a resemblance of personality.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the interesting thing about harmonics is that a harmonic does not have to be absolutely in tune to be a resonator of a fundamental.
Mm-hmm.
So my organ pipe, my 4 foot long organ pipe, can be a resonator of an 8 foot long organ pipe. But what if it's only 3.98 feet long rather than exactly 4 feet? Well, it'll be slightly out of tune.
Oh.
You may or may not be able to hear that it's out of tune, but it will still be a close enough approximation to that 8 foot fundamental at a close enough approximation to 4 feet to be an efficient resonator of that 8 foot fundamental.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that time works this way, that you need not have an exact copy of you to make a certain event a resonator or a harmonic of another event.
I see.
And now what this means is something very interesting. The further back in time that we go to us, the more the possibility of paradox disappears. Because any number of factors could lead to us genetically or a close approximation thereof, follow me, to a doppelganger.
Right.
So the further back we go, the more possible it is, which seems at odds unless you start understanding things in this kind of weird harmonic way.
Mm.
It seems paradoxical. We want to think of time travel as something more immediate to us. Mm-hmm. But I think it's exactly the opposite. Now, what this also means is that a very long-lived individual, such as we encounter in the Sumerian Kings List or the Egyptian Kings List, you know, these individuals that live thousands or if not tens of thousands of years long, that it's going to be much more difficult to encounter them because precisely they have such long individual memory. So the longer the memory, the more difficult it becomes. In fact, the longer the memory, the more likely it is that you're dealing with an individual rather than, you know, my harmonic approach here is also kind of a diatribe against reincarnation. Mm-hmm. Because I think reincarnation is more about the echoes of these harmonics than it is about an individual being repeated.
Mm-hmm.
It's the repetition here. You have to have an exact copy.
Right.
As we know, even twins are not exact copies. You know,
right.
They can be genetically identical, but personality-wise, no. Oftentimes, you're dealing with very different personalities. So there's a lot of factors in this But the basic idea of time as a harmonic phenomenon, I think, kind of ties all these things together in a way that begins to make sense, that we avoid the time paradox, that we can understand that if we go back and kill our grandfather, that doesn't mean we're killing ourselves. It may mean that the person that is us turns out to be slightly different in some weird way. On and on it goes.
But, you know, it's so unusual. It is. It's fascinating when you get on that level of consideration. It brings me into the Casey readings. And when you're dealing with the crystal part in this book, things really start to, like, I feel the whole explosion of the Atlantean story right underneath, about to burst through the entire thing.
Yeah.
In his version of Atlantis, you have the two-eyed stone crystal, which they called the terrible crystal. You have a very interesting quote in the book with Ezekiel calling this terrible crystal on top of this ship that he's seen.
Yeah, and the interesting thing in Ezekiel is that the crystals described there, and I think in Ezekiel you're actually giving kind of a little biblical reference to that part of esoteric Jewish tradition that has always said that space is a crystal. Most people don't know that, but that's actually part of Jewish occult thinking.
Fascinating, yeah.
So you're getting a little glimpse of it in Ezekiel. But the interesting thing in Ezekiel is that you not only have this reference to the terrible crystal, but it's occurring in an overall context that's talking about Lucifer and Lucifer's ephod or breastplate. I'm wearing my It's a Weapon t-shirt, by the way. but it's occurring in a context where this crystal is being talked about in reference to Lucifer. And again, what's Ezekiel describe about Lucifer? Thy tabrets and pipes were made perfect in thee. What's a tabret? Well, it's just an old English term for a membrane.
Oh, right. Yeah.
A pipe is a tube.
That's a weird description. If anything,
it's a weird description. You're either describing an organism or a machine, and here it comes, or a plasma.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, it gets even weirder, and I point this out in the second book, but Lucifer has an ephod in the book of Ezekiel. He has a breastplate. But if you read about Lucifer's breastplate, it's missing an entire row of what's on the Hebrew high priest's breastplate.
The Urim and Thummim.
The Urim and Thummim are not the ephod. They're not the breastplate. They're above the breastplate.
Okay.
The high priest's breastplate consists of 12 gemstones, arranged in four rows of three gemstones each, representing the 12 tribes of Israel.
Got it.
And the way Ezekiel refers, or pardon me, the Old Testament refers to these gemstones is that they are engraved with the names of the patriarchs of the 12 tribes. In other words, the sons of Jacob.
Right.
And the engraving is described in such a way to make it very clear that you're dealing with a kind of signet ring. In other words, it has to deal with governance. You know, in the Western church, a clergyman, particularly a bishop, will wear a signet ring. The Pope wears a signet ring. That's a symbol of his authority. And oftentimes the ring has a little seal that, you know, they use to seal wax documents. So in other words, you're dealing with a clear symbolism of governance. So Lucifer's ephod lacks three of those.
Huh.
It's very interesting when you read what they are. Very, very interesting. But in other words, the whole idea being communicated is that Lucifer's ephod is part of his governance.
Right.
So in other words, all of this is connected. Mm-hmm. The idea of crystal, the idea of governance, the idea of a power specific mm-hmm. to that crystal, the idea of plasma, this is all very, very highly interconnected. And with Casey, getting back to your point here, with Casey, I think you're dealing with somebody who's you know, kind of a proto-remote viewer.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at the way his readings are structured, he's being given a specific question. Like a remote viewer is given a specific question or a specific coordinate, and then he simply looks at it and describes what he's seeing. So in other words, I think you're dealing with Casey with kind of a prototypical remote viewer
mm-hmm.
who's following all the protocols, even though he doesn't know that he is.
Right.
And he's giving these descriptions on what he's seeing.
Fascinating. Absolutely.
And
that's the correlation. Yeah,
that's the correlation. And I think he's you know, some of his descriptions, you can kind of tell he's grasping for the words.
Mm-hmm.
But that means some of the descriptions may or may not be quite accurate, but they're here's the word again, they're close harmonics of it.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I think he's seeing something very genuine when he's talking about these Atlantean crystals, because they are there in almost all the world's lore about ancient civilizations. Right. The Vedas are full of references to crystals.
Yeah.
You know, the Old Testament, Jewish lore, all of this stuff is talking, where is this coming from and why mm-hmm. is it there? I suspect that if my speculation about the pyramid is true and that it had these metacrystals inside the structure, here's another thing for you. A crystal is grown and grows as a response to the local space-time gravitic conditions in which they grow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? This is why crystals grown in the zero gravity of space have fewer defects than crystals grown on Earth.
Interesting.
What this implies is that under certain conditions, if you had an adequate enough science of the lattice structure of crystals and their defects, you could read those defects and interpret the conditions in which that crystal was grown. In other words, the crystal is almost a biography of the geometry of the spatial conditions and temporal conditions. And that means something very interesting. That means that the older the crystal is, the more what? Memory it has.
Interesting.
And right. The closer it is to those original conditions of the cosmos. And this is why, again, all of those esoteric traditions stress the foundation stone of the world,
mm-hmm.
the Kaaba in Islam, the sapphire of Solomon, and so on and so forth. All of these things are suggesting that they knew that there were certain crystals that would be kind of memories of the history of creation or a lot of it, and that they're very, very old. Remember those crystals in the cosmic war in the Epic of Ninurta that cannot be destroyed?
Right.
And they're hidden away? Well, one reason I think that they are incapable of being destroyed and hidden away is that they're extremely old. And they're a record of those primordial conditions, and therefore being lower order derivatives, they're much more powerful in their effect. We're back to time harmonics again.
Interesting.
Yeah, this is all interrelated, folks, and wildly speculative. I want oh, yeah. to well,
What's fascinating about it, though, the crystal part, it seems to me, like you're saying, the core of so many of these systems go back to the crystal. Mm-hmm. The Casey piece, to kind of wind this around, mm-hmm. because I see a lot of correlations with what he says with what you're saying about the Giza Death Star. Here's the interesting part. He talks about, of course, we know the traditional dating of the pyramids, 2500 BC. And, you know, you show in the book that basically, you know, the dating around that is made up.
Oh, yeah.
And absolutely. The British have a heavy hand.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
You think? The pyramid, you know, here's the problem. And Herodotus, God bless him, it's right in the thick of it. And you just know he was writing this down with a grin on his face. Mm-hmm. Because Herodotus tells you that they spent an enormous amount of money on radishes, onion, and garlic to feed all the people that built this thing. And you just know he was laughing. But anyway, he also says that they built the stones, put the casing stones on the pyramid from the top down.
Wow. Oh, wow.
But I think what he's getting at there, and what others have noticed, you know, they have radiocarbon dated the mortar. There's a very, very thin layer of mortar between the stones of the Great Pyramid.
Yes.
It's almost paper thin. It's a ridiculously thin little layer. But they've carbon dated the mortar from the top and the bottom of the pyramid. And the problem is that the mortar at the top by carbon dating is older than the mortar at the bottom. Oh. So yeah, top down.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Well, it's explainable if there's a radioactive source inside the pyramid, because all those internal chambers of the Great Pyramid are much closer to the bottom of the pyramid than to the top. So any radiation affecting the mortar at the bottom is going to be more affected than the mortar at the top, and therefore carbon dating it is going to give you a skewed reading to begin with. Add to that the fact that the stones being quarried, and this was Herodotus's point, the stones being quarried, if they're going to be quarried from the same place, the stones at the top, as you're building this structure up, the stones at the top are going to come from a deeper layer of the quarry and then hence be geologically older than, you know, the stones at the bottom. So, yeah.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. But yeah, the structure makes no sense from the Egyptological point of view, because even the carbon dating, the youngest that they can get it to is about 500 years before dynastic Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
So folks, this means that half a millennium before Khufu is even a glint in dynastic Egypt's eye, someone built that dang thing, and it wasn't anything to do with dynastic Egypt.
Yes, absolutely not.
Absolutely not. No.
it's interesting because in the Casey story, the weird thing that he says, he's placing the construction at 10,500 BC.
And yes.
So we got 8,000 years of difference there. But he says, well, the reason they chose the site was they were doing archaeology.
Right.
So that's correct. Is a very, very ancient
site. Well, Casey's reading here is interesting because Casey is actually kind of repeating what the Egyptian Edfu temple texts tell you about the Giza compound. Because, again, they will tell you that the current site of Giza is the second layer of construction at that site. The original layer was destroyed, by the way, in a war.
Oh.
And then they came along and rebuilt over there.
So Casey, again, is not saying anything that the Egyptian texts themselves don't say.
Mm-hmm.
And I highly doubt, in fact, I'm 99.99% certain that Edgar Casey had absolutely no knowledge whatsoever of the Edfu Temple texts, nor had ever read them. So he's seeing the same thing.
Mm.
And here's the interesting thing. Since Casey is saying, well, the pyramid was built circa 10,500 BC, in other words, just prior to the flood, mm-hmm. by many people's dates, I'm not entirely convinced of it, but nonetheless, he's saying that the pyramid was built before the flood.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in this revision of the pyramid book, one of the epigraphs that I put into it was precisely the epigraph of the Arab tradition, referring to the Persians, who had a tradition that you could see the flood line on the pyramids, the two big pyramids of Egypt, about halfway up the structure.
Interesting.
So in other words, there is a tradition from that part of the world that those structures are older than the flood.
Incredible.
Now, if they're older than the flood, folks, Egyptians didn't build them. These are not the product of dynastic Egypt. And that's actually my position.
Joseph, just unbelievable information and insight. Stay right there, and we'll record part two for darkjournalist.com subscribers and go deep on the Casey Two-Eye Stone research, Hermes, and the Tesla-Osiris connection to all this. The new book, Giza Death Star Revisited, is available at GizaDeathStar.com, and it's a full update of the original, as Joseph said, with a new added chapter that the world may finally be ready for. Now join us tomorrow night for a special X-Series presentation 2024 preview right here at 8 p.m. See you soon.